Back in the background here, you know.
Aaron, trust our emotional touchstone. Trust him. I am Kavrick the Savage, a sixth level barbarian.
Okay. I found my dice.
Okay.
I've got my drinks and I've got my snacks to crunch loudly.
Yes, good. Cheetos.
Okay.
Where are the Cheetos?
Okay, well then I am Murgos the Arcane.
Oh, perfect.
Murgos
the Arcane.
The Arcane. I'm going to reveal my character, my NPC character name in the podcast because it's special.
Okay. It better not be something like Thiefy McBackstab.
No. It's good. It's an awesome. It's an awesome fantasy name.
Okay.
I wish I had.
Okay. All right.
And then
Thiefy McBackstab.
It's
I'm
not,
good.
It's not.
Could you close the door?
Yes, of course.
What's your what's your thief name?
Marcus.
Marcus. Really? Marcus?
That's like Jerry. It's Jerry the Vampire.
It's M-A-R-Q-U-I-S-S.
Oh.
It's not Marquise?
Marquise.
The Marquis of Snakes. The Marquis of Snakes.
Mickey can edit out or where we sound stupid.
Yeah, he's going to be editing a lot.
All right, gentlemen, you enter into the next chamber. The door has been opened, it was locked, but now you're entering in. It's a large chamber, and there's a strong, sour odor that's coming from what appears to be a huge bear sprawled up against the wall. It's just the skin. And decorating all around the corners of the room are heads in various stages of decomposition. Elven, dwarven, human. And there's a really strong, strong odor of decay in the room as well.
All right. Kavrick the Savage wants to know if he can use his heightened senses to detect any enemies in the shadows.
Kavrick the Savage listens carefully. His highly trained ear picks up what sounds like breathing coming from the northwest corner.
Oh, this is not my forte.
Nay, nay, step back. Allow Murgos the Arcane, sorcerer, to use my ebony rune-covered staff of the Old Ones to detect any evil magic or sorcery that possibly emanates from where those voices come.
Okay, go ahead and use your detect magic spell.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
Yes.
There is a magical presence here.
I knew it.
I hate magic.
Silence, you thief!
Oh, hi. Oh, excuse us. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge. We're the Gentleman Nerds. You've come in at a very unique time. We're all sort of gathered around here having some drinks and playing some D&D, old school style.
Hey guys, what's up?
Hey, I was about to cast my spell, but yeah, go ahead.
Come on in, yeah. Wow, this is great. We've actually been also talking about the influence that Sword and Sorcery has had on fantasy gaming and fantasy entertainment. Sword and Sorcery, of course, being from great books and series and pulp magazines and novels. And nothing really, I think, encompasses this feeling more than a good fashioned game of Dungeons and Dragons. And that's kind of what we're doing here. But you guys pull up a chair and get a drink. Why don't you join us here at the Gentleman Nerds? Hey, we're all playing the game. You can listen in, but we're going to have a good conversation. I'm going to introduce the Gentleman Nerds and their characters that they are playing in this game. Here's Mickey Finn.
Hello, my name is Marcus. I'll be your thief for the evening.
Mark Finn.
I am Kavrick the Savage, a sixth level barbarian that bears no resemblance to a certain strong thewed giant by Robert E. Howard.
And Aaron D'Arrive.
And I am Murgos the Arcane, pale-skinned, sickly king of an ancient people whose power has now dwindled, and it's nothing like Elric of Meldebonay. Nothing at all.
Nice. I'm Joseph Fotinos. I'm acting as DM for this game. I also have an NPC in the game. He's an elvish archer, very much in the Tolkien sense. I'm not really good at thinking up fantasy names, so I just named this one Farnash. That was pretty good.
Is that
Farnash the Elf.
Is that his first name or his last name?
It's his last name. He just goes by his last
I
name.
I think that, that's smart.
But that's Farnash with an umlaut.
Yeah. That's right. That's correct.
So. It's only funny if you know stuff. If you don't know anything, it's fine.
Welcome, folks. Welcome. And you guys, thanks for playing. This is fun. By the way, the room that you're entering, we'll put on pause, and we'll have an encounter after we chat.
Okay. All right. Well, we have to there's two, as I see it, there's two godfathers of the sword and sorcery genre that are the largest influence in Dungeons & Dragons in terms of propping up the broad bones of Dungeons and Dragons, and that is
I would argue there's also a great uncle, but go ahead.
Certainly, but in terms of the base components, right?
Yeah.
As we understand it, Tolkien and Robert E. Howard are the two guys. With Tolkien, the early wargaming efforts were initially established when they started, instead of doing 18th century Boer War stuff. Instead, they were doing the Battle of Helm's Deep with elves and goblins, right? The races and the overall architecture of the politics and the way that the races interacted, the elves and the dwarves and the hobbits or halflings and the orcs and the goblins, that was all from Tolkien. But the dungeon crawls, the spelunking, the entering into the gothic decrepit ruins and finding ancient weapons and horrible monsters and crazed necromancers, that's Robert E. Howard. And those two very broad general set pieces, which are the hallmark of Dungeons & Dragons, is what that foundation was built on. Real quick, we get into Jack Vance and Michael Moorcock and Fritz Leiber, and they all bring their own stuff in, but those were the two guys that propped them up initially. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'll admit to being not as well versed in the fantasy origins as my fellow gentlemen nerds. I played Dungeons and Dragons for many years, Origin of Recipe, thank you very much, and enjoyed the hell out of it. But it never occurred to me that the influences came from anything else but just Gygax's imagination. And of course they did. And especially when I watched, or read The Hobbit or read Lord of the Rings, I recognized, but in my brain as a kid, I never knew which came first, because I was like, oh, this is a great book. And, oh, look, they got a goblin. I'm playing Dungeons and Dragons. There's goblins in there, too. It never occurred to me that one influenced the other.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I think the way Dungeons and Dragons has come to be played, the world influence certainly comes from Tolkien. It was very hard to find an early D&D game or setting until we start getting into much later things like Dark Sun and things like that. But it was almost impossible to find an early fantasy role-playing game, and we're talking now early 80s, early to mid-80s, that did not have elves, dwarves, hobbits, goblins, dragons, Dungeons and Dragons itself, the name. But so the world influence definitely comes from Tolkien. But the style, like what you do in a D&D game, when you get your adventuring friends and you start plundering dungeons and crypts and things like that, that is absolutely Robert E. Howard.
Robert E. Howard. Yeah.
Who
was the great grandfather?
The two great uncles obviously are Moorcock Leiber. Is who I would say. I mean, there's some Clark Ashton Smith in there. There's a lot of other writers that started influencing certainly what came to be known as sword and sorcery, which kind of find out Leiber actually coined the term sword and sorcery.
That's right.
Because they wanted to know what do we call this?
Oh, really?
And at the time there was sword and sandal movies.
Yes,
Italian.
Yes, yeah.
So they said, okay, well, if there's sword and sandal movies fantasy, then this is sword and sorcery.
Huh. Okay. And you named some of the authors, but for our guests, and I'm asking for a friend, of course, can you give me some titles of some of these books that I might look up? Because I'm really keen on reading some of this sword and sorcery of original recipe.
It's funny that you mention this, because in the original Dungeon Master's Guide, the hardcover that came out set up AD&D, there was at the back of the book in Appendix N, there was a list of inspirational and educational reading.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And this,
I haven't thought about that in years.
And this list is, if anybody's interested, you can find it online. I'll quickly read you who the guys are. because it really is not only just a who's who, it's great reading, and especially if you like seeing how the sausage was made, you can go through all this stuff and really get the inferences of D&D.
Yeah.
But it's also just a really good list. You know, if you just like, well, I feel like dipping into this, trust me, it'll all be good. Paul Anderson, John Bellairs, Lee Brackett, Frederick Brown, Edgar Rice Burroughs, yeah. Lynn Carter, L. Sprague DeCamp, DeCamp and Fletcher Pratt, August Derleth, Lord Dunsany, Philip Jose Farmer, Gardner Fox, Robert E. Howard, Sterling Lanier, Fritz Leiber, H.P. Lovecraft, A. Merritt, Michael Moorcock, Andre Norton, Andrew J. Offutt, Fletcher Pratt again, Fred Saberhagen, Margaret St. Clair, J.R.R. Tolkien, Jack Vance, Stanley Weinbaum, Manly Wade Wellman, one of my all-time favorites.
That's a great name.
Jack Williamson, and Roger Zelazny.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. There you go. That's the comprehensive list there.
And if you go online and Google AD&D Appendix M, it'll give you some of the titles to check out. And in some cases, these authors only have one book that they recommended. Mm-hmm. And in other cases, it was just like, yeah, read everything.
Right.
And of course, they do have a new list with 5th edition that's mm-hmm. got new people since then. But
right.
but just for all of us 40-somethings, this yeah. early list is a really good starter.
Yeah, early and early list meaning everything from about, you know, the 30s to about the 70s
yeah.
or so.
Yeah.
And then you get a whole new wave who, by the way, are influenced
yeah.
by the works of Leiber and Moorcock.
That's right.
and Tolkien and Robert E. Howard. And so now they're the whole new generation of writers, fantasy writers, come up with things like George R. R. Martin
right.
and many, 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 many
the
others.
The Thieves' World books.
Yes.
Which, yeah.
by the way, I think the Thieves' World books are, well, I think they're quite excellent. But talk about, this was the first time that I was aware of that somebody took the concept of D&D and sort of did the reverse, made a world out of something that felt very D&D.
And for those who don't know at home, Thieves' World was a series of anthologies of major and some minor at the time authors in a shared universe,
yeah.
mostly originally in one town.
Which is brilliant because, again, the whole idea of the way your typical D&D adventure goes is you get a group of adventurers, anywhere from two to upwards of seven or eight. They all meet in a town, usually in a tavern, which was, again, the Vulgar Unicorn was the tavern in Thieves' World. It had a variety of different characters that all got together of a variety of different disciplines. There was assassins, sorcerers, witches, mercenaries, barbarians, etc. And they all come together and have a series of either solo adventures or they team up in twos and threes and have these sort of stories. And it was a brilliant way to show something like, well, if authors were to start writing about a D&D world, it would very much read like Thieves' World. This is what it would be like. Well, there we were at the Vulgar Unicorn lifting a tankard of ale when a stranger stumbles in, that sort of thing, and then
mm-hmm.
you know, adventure begins.
And the characters would sometimes wander their ways in and out of other authors' stories.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the fun part of the shared world thing was that One Thumb, who's the bartender,
right.
he shows up in more than one story and has his own story as well.
Yeah, and the
who,
first
who wrote the shared world stories or who were the authors?
Each author was different. Robert Asprin was the editor on the series.
Ah, okay,
And Andrew J. Offutt had some stuff in there. I'm blanking on the list.
Me.
Oh, Janet Morris, C.J. Chera is in here, Paul Anderson,
yeah.
John Bruner. I mean, it's an amazing list of people early on. Lynn Abbey is involved. Joe Haldeman did some stuff.
Mercedes Lackey?
She does not no, but Vonda and McIntyre is here.
Okay.
So there's a really cool
Marion Zimmer Bradley.
Marion Zimmer Bradley, that's who I'm thinking of.
Yeah, she was an early contributor. Lynn Abbey, of course.
Yeah,
I mean Paul Anderson, Andrew Offutt, Robert Asprin, of course. You know, well-known authors. Philip Jose Farmer, who apparently wrote Spiders of the Purple Mage. So no, there was Janet Morris. there was a large number of and by the way, what's great about this, and a lot of people don't know this, or maybe now they do, that George R. R. Martin's become so popular. But George R. R. Martin is a well known and very dedicated gamer, and has been gaming with a group of his friends, many of them fellow authors, for many, many years.
Yeah.
There's another series called Wild Cards about basically superheroes in a New York that's been infected. The world's been infected by an alien virus that starts turning people into either monsters or superheroes. But that originally was a Superworld game that he ran for his friends. He also ran fantasy games, and I believe still plays in or runs the birth of what we now know as the Game of Thrones. That had its birth in a fantasy setting for a game, and it's funny because I think if you look at a lot of well-known authors now today, fantasy authors, I would venture to guess that a good percentage of them either played D&D or something like D&D, and the kernel of the idea for their eventual work came from a role-playing game.
I'm pretty sure the world-building for the Jared novels is probably from a role-playing game.
Oh, probably. Yeah. I mean, and I think that's why those settings are so rich and why they work so well. Because, you know, unless you're Tolkien, who just does this obsessively because he's just interested in the subject of world building and culture creation and language creation, when you're telling a story, a lot of authors don't really sit down and think, all right, what's this world like? What are the people like? What's the culture like? What's the history like? You know, what does the land look like? Now I think it's pretty traditional. I think back in the day, maybe it didn't happen so much. They had a story they wanted to tell. And again, I'm actually selling many authors short. I know Howard put a lot of thought into
Hyborian Age.
Yeah, and I think a lot of games now have trained people, role playing games, and we're talking not computer games, although we'll talk about that in a minute because that's been a huge influence also. I mean, Sword and Sorcery has influenced video games. But in paper games, we've been trained when you're going to build a world, when you're going to tell a story, you have to build this elaborate setting around it. You have to build this world so that story rings true, so those characters seem real, the decisions they make are directed by something. Their experiences are influenced by certain events. And so it's standard now, and wouldn't you gentlemen agree that it's when someone's going to write a fantasy novel now, let the world creation begin.
Yeah, you have to at some point in the process stop and build your world, and sometimes that's a two sentence thing, and sometimes it derails you for a month while you go research, you know, what was the earliest appearance of steam powered machinery in a pre Iron Age society.
I'm adapting a screenplay that Aaron here wrote into a novel form, and I'm trying to change some things, and I'm getting sidetracked left and right just doing that. And that's not even a fantasy world. That's based in reality.
It's amazing. You know, when I sit down to write like a screenplay, which is even more trimmed down than something that you would read in, like, let's say a 500 page novel, the amount of time that I spend looking at various legends and lore and history and all that sort of thing. Oh my God. I spend months and months and months, but that's good because by the time I'm ready to sit down and start writing, I have all this information. It doesn't necessarily always show in the work, but it informs what I'm writing, and that's that is just, it's crucial. It's vital.
If you're a budding young author, a fatal mistake that you could use would be to try to cram every cool thing that you've created into your story.
Yeah.
It needs to all be background stuff, and then when it's relevant, then the coolness comes out.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, I've just rolled for surprise. From the back of the room, the bear skin comes crashing down. It was hiding a gigantic opening, and out of that opening rushes into the room a blue-skinned, two-headed giant carrying clubs, an Eaton. The Eaton swings its club and roars in anger and rushes forward.
I'm surprised. Are you surprised?
I am not surprised. I knew this was coming.
That's right. He is a barbarian with the instincts of a wolf. Not going to be surprised.
What would Conan do in a situation like this?
Conan would draw his sword and rush forward, because there is nothing that bleeds that cannot be killed. You know, only upon determining if it doesn't bleed would Conan reassess that situation. You know?
That's true.
Well, because of the Eaton's tough skin and the hide he wears all over him, he's got a fairly high armor class.
Uh-oh.
Why don't you roll to hit and see what you do?
All right, hold on.
Come on.
I rolled a 14.
Okay, but your pluses are added in there. Your sword is a plus 5, isn't it?
So that's a 19.
There you go. That's pretty cool. And then you've got your strength bonus.
Yes.
I'd say that's a hit with a double damage.
Yeah, there we go. And
can I just get some damage on that?
Hold on.
Come on, Mark. Come on.
Oh.
Because my nightmare is to be eaten by an Eaton.
12
his name
points.
12 points, and we double that damage. That's going to be a nice 24 points of damage. The mighty barbarian swings his sword, and it slices directly into the side of the Eaton's neck on the right side.
Nice.
The right side neck drops, the head falls limp, and the entire right side of the body collapses. The Eaton is still alive, but only the left side.
Uh-oh. Caprick says, come on, you dogs, if it bleeds, we can kill it.
Ah, excellent.
Farnash launches 3 arrows at the Eaton, and... 2 of them pierce its hide and stick in, doing minimal damage, but there's arrows now sticking out of them.
Nice! Mickey, are you going to finish him off, or shall Murgos the Arcane call forth his power?
As much as I hate magic, it is a pretty show, so go ahead.
Very well. Then I lift my pale, bony hand, calling forth the dark powers, Ea, Ea, Cthulhu Fatagan, and I unleash, a gate opens, and I unleash a demon that will come out and finish and will eat the Eaten.
Because that always ends well.
It eats as easy.
Well, let's see if I do that. Hold on, let me. Oh, shoot. I rolled a 1.
You okay, so... chucklehead.
I am so sorry.
That is a total
Elric, I am not.
the mighty staff, the rune-covered staff, slipped right out of his hand.
No,
and landed with a thud onto the ground, and the pit that opens up, or is starting to open up, closes suddenly around the Eaton. Although the Eaton, it's not walking, it's only half alive, so you guys could probably just finish him off pretty easily.
So pale, so weak.
Is his name Will?
Well,
kill him, I say, because clearly I've not taken my potions, my magical drafts that would give me strength. I collapse to my knees, and my hand shakes and reaches out for my barbarian friend. Finish him off.
All right. Marcus, if you would please go around to the back and distract him.
Caper, bells, caper, caper.
You know, you are the strangest thief, I have to say. When you told me what your character was wearing, I thought, that's an unusual choice for a thief. And yet here he is, clad head to toe in jingly bells.
Because
but, hey,
he was going to ask me to do stuff like this. I'm always a fancy monkey.
Wow, right. I thought I was a bad sorcerer. No.
The worst party ever.
All right, no, hold on, I can do this. All right, I roll a 17. Yes.
That's a hit. Why don't you just finish this sucker off?
All right, hold on. Yeah. And it's... another 12 points.
The Eaton shudders with its final death throes as the barbarian lowers its sword and covers himself with a splatter of the Eaton's blood. With a shake and a tremble, it lies limp.
That's not going to
happen. Excellent.
All right, search the room, dudes.
Okay, behind the bearskins on the walls.
It was the opening where the Eaton came through.
Okay, is there any, are there any piles of trash or anything that the Eaton used as a nest?
Remember, there was in the corner, there were a series of heads. There were decapitated heads that were lined up in the corner. So you could dig around in there that's sitting on top of leaves and sticks and twigs and things of that sort.
Morgus, dig around in the heads.
Morgus, go see if one of those heads is the dwarf we were sent to find.
Very well. Are you sure? I don't want to mess this up, too.
Well.
Very well. I collect my rune-covered staff, and I rise slowly to my feet, and I go and check on the severed heads, using my powerful ring of ultimate identification.
Ooh, nice. The heads are in a state, such a state of decay. It does sort of lend the idea that it's not the dwarf you were looking.
Okay, good.
It's not Deldrock, the dwarf.
Nay, my friends, Deldrock is not among
the heads. All right, the prince still lives.
His sister will be so depressed.
Then we have got no choice but to go through the opening.
Let's do it.
Farnash, the elf, goes up to the opening and gazes down into its darkness, using his improvision to see if he can spot anything.
And is decapricated.
He's decapricated.
Wow! He's decapricated. I think that's a Hollywood term.
It's decapricated? It's what happens at the end of It's a Wonderful Life.
He wasn't a penitent man. Only the penitent man shall pass.
I like that.
All right. Well, we'll pause here.
Okay.
The idea behind exploring dungeons and having these types of adventures, you said that they were really coming from Robert E. Howard?
Yeah, Howard's world was essentially a lived-in place. You know, at the time that Conan is treading the jeweled sands, the world has already been lived in for a couple of different epochs, and the Hyborian Age was just the most recent one on its way to being the modern world. And so many times, thieves and sorcerers find themselves looking through ancient ruins. Now, of course, what's interesting about this is that the Hyborian Age, for our purposes, is roughly 15,000 to 19,000 years before the modern age. So for Conan to be looking at ancient ruins with pre-Atlantean markings on them, you know, indicating that this is something that was around, you know, 10,000 years prior to that, is significant. And that Gothic sort of conceit is something that Jack Vance uses in The Dying Earth to great effect, and one of the reasons why he's on the Appendix N list. But Howard was really the guy to sort of, you know, talk about how there were different ages of man. And at the time that the Hyborian Age is around, Atlantis is gone. But the sorcery and the super science that was part of that culture, there's remnants of it in the world before the Hybori sweep down from the north and take everything over and subvert the culture and make it their own again. And so those layers of history, like a 7-layer dip of coolness, you know, is part of what makes the Conan stories very compelling. You know, you feel like you're in a lived-in world.
Right.
And this, of course, is something that I think, you know, this is my premise, and if you guys disagree, we can certainly talk about this, but the idea that you had all of this disparate material out there. You had pulps, you had novels, you had movies, and there was certainly an influence in some of that stuff as well. Although they weren't as prevalent then, but the Harryhausen stuff that we talked about in the last episode was certainly a factor in some of this. It all coalesced, and in Dungeons & Dragons, it was that game and the games that it spawned was the first time that we had a chance to take these disparate elements ourselves and reconfigure them. Okay, we made new art out of old.
Oh yeah,
in that capacity, and in doing so, that new art, some of it was derivative. In fact, most of it was shitty, but some of it. Some of it rose up, and it wasn't long after. It was almost, it feels like a matter of weeks between Dungeons & Dragons, the role-playing game, and the very earliest text-based computer games.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
There is a direct connection from role-playing fantasy role-playing games.
And being eaten by Gru.
And being eaten by Eaton. And then all of the people, because all of the guys who were programming these early games were playing D&D.
That's right.
and had been influenced heavily by things like that. I mean,
I still love one of the greatest titles is Wizardry or Sorcery. I'm not sure which. 201 Sorcerers Get All the Girls.
Nice.
I love that game.
And Richard Garriott, Lord British, has said many times that Dungeons & Dragons, you know, Tolkien's works and things like that were big influences on his early game, Akalabeth, which of course became the Ultima series, which then again was heavily influenced games that followed it, including Elder Scrolls and you know all the stuff that all the kids are playing today.
Even before that, with the arcade game craze, we had a couple of significant ones. The first one that I remember that I just loved to death and still do is Dragon's Lair.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
the first ever cell animated video game.
Don Bluth
Studio, and it was basically, essentially, it was the equivalent now of what we would do with a DVD player. It was a giant laser disc that was programmed to go in certain directions, and if you interrupted that direction at just the right time, it would take you to the screen where Dirk the Daring cuts off the snake's head and walks through the door.
Right.
But if you don't, the snake's going to wrap itself around Dirk the Daring, and then you just have to start back all over again. It was a beautiful piece of work. And shortly thereafter...
I spent so many quarters on that game.
Oh, yeah, me too.
left, right, left, right.
Growing up, my father owned a video game room in Houston, Leo's Game Room in Westheimer and Voss, for those of you who grew up in Houston, was my father. He owned that, and we were one of the first video game arcades to receive Dragon's Lair.
Mm.
And people were sitting there, it was like watching a movie. It was a huge crowd.
Yeah.
Somebody's playing Dragon's Lair, and everyone's kind of peering over his shoulder trying to see this amazing game.
Yeah,
you know?
It was a spectator sport,
absolutely. Good stuff.
Did you ever, Joseph, put the thing on test and watch it all the way through?
Yes, the whole thing, yes. After Hours we did.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That and Space Ace.
And Space Ace was also just as good. But then right after that, or shortly thereafter, came the game Gauntlet. And I think Gauntlet was one of the ones that basically got us over to Diablo and those other type of games. Because it was
a three-quarter
view look down, you know. And I remember we all played the Bejesus out of Gauntlet, too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and then again, that dynamic of the party wandering around the dungeon that Diablo used and Gauntlet used and many other games now use came directly from Dungeons & Dragons.
And I know Gauntlet had this, but was it the original configuration where you had four stations around a cocktail table?
I believe it
showed up like that, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So four people could play different characters.
Yes.
Yes.
No, Mark, you
Barbarian
mentioned
needs food.
Some of the some of the creatures and things that he encounters in the Dungeons and Dragons world, or world playing worlds in general, they're standards. You've got your orcs, you've got your goblins, you've got your hobgoblins, your kobolds,
trolls, dragons.
But there were some that I personally would, and not knowing any better, thought, well, again, Gygax thought these things up. And he may have. And I'll bring up a couple of monsters and see what your reactions, if you know any literary sources or inspirations behind them. Maybe you could share that with us. The owlbear, which I thought was an odd thing to have a bear with an owl beak, essentially.
There is there are several monsters from the original Monster Manual that were used in Gygax's original campaign, and they came from a Korean or Japanese.
The toy set.
It was a toy set.
Correct. The Rust Monster came from that. Owl Bear came from that.
Okay.
The Beyonder, or the Beholder?
No, the Beholder was a different thing.
Yeah, the Beholder was not. But
that seems Lovecraftian,
the
Beholder.
Was a Displacer Beast, I think, was one of the ones that came from that.
Like the cat with the tentacles.
Yes,
I think
that came from that.
That's right. Okay, I remember hearing that story, but I wasn't sure how apocryphal that was, or if it was actually, okay, so he saw these little toys and went, cool, I'm going to call it this.
I think what he was doing was, initially for Gygax, for him, everything was seat of your pants, or not necessarily seat of your pants, but if it was in his house, it was fair game. And so I think he was looking for monsters to show.
Yeah, they're miniatures, so you could just put them on a little hex map.
Here's my next step. He's sitting there at dinner, and he's having dessert, and he's having Jello, and he's like, wait a minute.
A gelatinous
you! Yeah.
I don't doubt that for a minute. But then, of course, they were also very smart to go in and strip mine you know, these other works. And right. there were a number of wonderful sort of things man was not meant to know sort of creatures in the early things. These sort of...
Oh, yeah. Demons and devils.
Yeah, you know. Demons and devils and amorphous they blobs took, and shapes, you know.
He took names from actual mythology and
Those were heavily influenced by
Demogorgons and the Orcuses of the world. Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't think there's a direct connection, but I always remember... because in the Star Wars film, when they're in the trash compactor, and that eyeball comes out and looks at them, and it's called a Dianogu. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I remember that or know that, but it was called a Dianogu. And then in the D&D, at one point we're wandering around some huge room that's got all kinds of filth and garbage, and we're attacked by a Neo-Atyug.
Yep.
And we're Neo-Atyug, is this in any way like the Dianogu from the trash compactor? Because it's found in trash, it's surrounded by filth, it has a little eye stalk that can come up
and
look.
It's got like three legs and a big body. And
it's just the weirdest looking creature.
Or the Zorn.
The Zorn's another one,
I
that has
the
mouth on the top of its head and three arms, and it eats precious metals. It eats magic and precious metals.
Yeah, that sounds Asian, actually.
Yes, talk about something that you found in a pack of Japanese plastic toys, like in the 70s, and you went, huh, that's a Zorn. I'm going to call that a Zorn. Absolutely. No. And there was a lot of, I mean, I think Lovecraft is where Lovecraft's influence is felt in D&D.
That's right.
It's the creatures. A lot of the creatures are these weird nightmarish,
tentacles.
You know, although they're not all the same thing, but like things like night gaunts, some version
flare,
of that in there.
With its
absolutely.
Yes.
With the weird octopus-headed creatures. Mm-hmm. I think Lovecraft was a big influence.
I said earlier, The Beholder's got to be something that Lovecraft influenced. Has anyone ever heard of anything like that? The floating eye tyrant sphere of death.
That's a good question.
I don't think that came from anything.
I don't think it came from literature. I think that was probably a Gygaxian thing.
I'm sure somebody made it up.
Yeah. Somebody in Trouble in Little China fell back through time.
There you go. It's a big eyeball with tentacles with eyeballs. Yeah,
at that same dinner where he's eating the Jell-O, someone must have said, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And he went,
beholder.
Eyes, I get it.
But it's hard to imagine for a modern audience, you know, because D&D is over 40 years old now, but it's hard to imagine there was a time period when that's all we were playing. I mean, that really it took over. And
Fat
it was
Traveler
such,
and Car Wars.
It was such a big influence that it spilled over into video games. It spilled over into board games. It really became... a part of it, at that point it was subculture. It was a subculture of this geek universe, which encompassed all this stuff. But what happened was every one of those nerds grew up to be computer programmers. And as soon as they could get their hands on it, they started making adventure games. And D&D was one of the first adventure series that was licensed by a computer company. That's where Bard's Gate came from. That's where Ultima Online came from. And that spins off as we get into the 90s and we start looking at Diablo and we start looking at the Elder Scrolls. This becomes, you know, it's weird how it almost becomes. I don't want to imply that in becoming the Ouroboros, it's self-destructing. But it's definitely circular, and each iteration completes the circle and starts a new circle, you know, right next to it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So there's this continuing spiral of influences.
And how it branches out, even with the sandbox role-playing games.
Yeah.
Forever and a day, people seem to think that Grand Theft Auto 3 was like the first big sandbox game. Elder Scrolls was there first.
Right.
Explain the concept of a sandbox.
Sandbox means that you're not on rails. You are not guided along a storyline. There are quests and everything and storylines.
Also called open world. You can go anywhere. You can look at anything. You can involve yourself in any of dozens.
That mountain
of
looks
quests,
interesting. I'm
not in any specific order.
Right. I've played a few of those games myself. I didn't recognize sandbox. I recognized the open world.
Okay. Yeah.
But sandbox.
Yeah,
okay.
Sandbox. So you can go anywhere and play with
anywhere you want to.
And by the way, some prominent public figures who have are known to play Dungeons and Dragons, and that's just D&D. I'm not even talking about the many, many other role-playing games out there that were spawned in the 80s. But Stephen Colbert, Chris Hardwick, the musician Moby, Vin Diesel, Matthew Lillard, Mike Myers, Patton Oswalt, Will Wheaton, of course, has made sort of that a career as of him promoting games and role-playing games and things like that. Robin Williams. And the list, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. It's just, again, it is just a way for people to indulge their imagination, their creativity, and a lot of these people come to it very young. So I don't know about you guys, but I started playing D&D right around, I think, like 79 or 80. Is when I started playing, and it was the very basic, very simple
blue box.
And so then from that, you know, other people started introducing mm-hmm. other games to our group, Traveler, and then all of the other games that TSR mm-hmm. Came up with, Boot Hill and Top Secret and Gamma World, all these other things.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
But again, you know, it's all this all had its birthplace in sword and sorcery role playing, which had its influence and birth in sword and sorcery fiction, literature, in the works of Howard, as we have stated. And
how many of you guys had the metal figures? Collected the metal figures and painted them.
The lead ones, yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I had quite a collection of them. And they were some amazing Ralph Partha sculpted things, and I just loved those box sets. You could get all thieves and all wizards and all fighters.
Yeah.
And then there was a miscellaneous monster set that, you know,
or your pack of orcs,
whatever.
I mean, I always sucked at painting them, especially the eyes. All my characters looked like Marty Feldman.
All my characters were all one color, so you know.
I was horrible at painting them, but
they're all red.
Yeah.
Red ones go faster.
Yeah. I loved it, and then of course. You know, these influenced games, they influenced video games, computer games, and then now influencing movies and TV shows and, you know, things like that, where the language that you would need that would be totally alien to somebody who would never experienced any kind of a role-playing game, now the language is much more familiar. People understand. It was just a World of Warcraft movie, which apparently didn't do well here, but just completely killed in China. So there's going to be a sequel to the World of Warcraft. And the World of Warcraft absolutely is a D&D clone that has now become a successful movie. It'll be online. Uh-huh. I'm sure it'll become a successful TV show.
And for those who didn't know World of Warcraft before the online version of the game, it was a very simplistic build your village and make sure you don't get killed. Go out and get resources and stuff like that. So when it was just like this, it was a matter of, it's a clone, big deal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're building a village in a D&D type setting, big deal, you know, no big deal. But then it grew into some big, huge thing with the
armies and things like that. As far as, you know, great memories of playing Dungeons and Dragons, I mean, I have so many, staying up late, you know, in high school and in college, of course. College, my gosh, that's all we did. We picked D&D. But I do remember there was a backlash, and this came from concerned parent groups and religious groups, that because it was an unusual game, they thought something must be up with this. Wait, there's no board? There's no character tokens? You don't move across the board? How do you win?
Yeah.
And I think that scared people into thinking somehow, some way. And of course, the content of it, there's swords and mystical monsters
and
magic and demons and devils.
That's right.
And all these things that are raising red flags in the 80s during the big devil scare. And Jack Chick, Chick Tracks, were these little comics that were distributed by church groups. Sometimes on the streets you could get them, or people would put them in their Halloween trick-or-treat bags, which would really annoy me. But it was always the warning against different things. You know, don't worship the devil, kids, and don't celebrate Halloween, because that's the devil's holiday. And certainly don't play Dungeons & Dragons, because that's a gateway into witchcraft and Satanism.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely a terrifying, ooh, the boogeyman's going to get you kind of thing. I remember they even made a movie, a TV movie called Mazes and Monsters.
With Tom Hanks.
Young Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks' career is owed to Dungeons & Dragons.
he plays a guy who loves this Mazes and Monsters thinly disguised version of Dungeons and Dragons so much that he loses his mind and goes to live in the sewers where he thinks he's fighting monsters.
Now, this was based on a true. This was based on something that actually happened.
It was.
It was a guy. It was a young man in actual Dallas, Texas. And of course it made headlines, and the headlines were as accurate as woman spills McDonald's coffee sues company. What the headlines never mentioned was that this kid had a history of mental illness and was actually diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. He wasn't on his meds. They did not know how to take care of him. I read the book that the private investigator wrote who was tasked with finding and recovering him, you know. And essentially, you know, it's a very sad story.
Yeah, and even more tragically than he had some mental issues. So much of it, and this is completely glossed over, so much of it had to do with he was gay. And he was fighting with those feelings of wanting to be accepted, of wanting to embrace that, and his parents being very homophobic, and him feeling that they would never understand. A lot of what he would do, it was thought, when he would run away, was he'd go stay with male friends who were similarly inclined. And so it really is a sad story about a young gay man who just cannot. He cannot find. He lives in a world that does not accept him.
But all anybody heard was guy plays Dungeons and Dragons, goes nuts, runs away to fight monsters in the storm tunnels.
And imagine if that had been on the internet now.
Well,
funny you should say that, because on the internet now you can go to chick.com, again, Jack Chick and his propaganda or anti-everything propaganda world, you can pull up articles written in this year about the dangers of role-playing games and or Dungeons & Dragons.
Sure.
And I quote, unsavory aspects of the game. One pro D&D psychologist wrote that there's hardly a game in which the players do not indulge in murder, arson, torture, rape, or highway robbery. Those are not games that I'm playing. I know. I don't ever remember. Please roll for rape. I don't remember doing that.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is that, you know, there's a term now, very well accepted term in video role-playing game circles. It's called a murder hobo.
Yes.
And it's what you call somebody who basically goes into a game and their sole purpose is to kill everything that they see and plunder them.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah. Well, playing it like
Doom. That's basically what you do. I mean, that's essentially what you do.
I guess, but I mean, you know, like, okay, they say fear generation via casting spells and mental imaging about fear-filled emotional scenes and threats to survival of the characters. That's the game, essentially.
Yeah.
Right? That's the game.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'll share a personal story. My mom also worried that we were involved in devil worship. This was in the early 80s. And, oh, my God, what's this game? And she's very religious, and she didn't understand, and she didn't want to I have to stop you from doing this. I have to take your books away, whatever it is. And so I said, look, Mom, I'm going to invite everybody over. We're going to come to the house, and we're going to play a game, and you can watch us. Now, of course, I was smart. We didn't play D&D. We were playing Champions at the time. And so I said, okay. So everybody came over to the house, and we were all playing our superheroes that were off doing things like battling supervillains and saving innocent people and stopping the bad guys from, you know, destroying the world. And she sat there and watched us for a while, and she was like, oh, okay. You boys want some food? I'll make some food. Sure, Mom. And that's it. From that day forward, we'd play at my house. My mom would always make us, we'd have pizza, we'd have tacos, we'd have whatever she would make us. And she loved it. She knew we weren't out on the street, you know, high or drunk or, you know, getting anybody pregnant. So that we're
Well, gosh, if you're playing D&D, you ain't getting anyone pregnant. But I mean, it is, and my experience was much the same. We played D&D at the house. All my friends would come over. We'd order pizza. My mom was thrilled because we were all just sitting around playing games and having a good time, laughing.
Yep.
I mean, I guess it's about how seriously you take this. Now, I've never been in a campaign where we lit candles and wore black robes and played scary music. Well, I take it back. I did play scary music during Ravensloft, but that was just cool atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah.
But
we,
you know,
we play music all the time. Yeah, for movies.
Sound effects and stuff like that. But I mean, it's all very theatrical. We were all actors in the theater, theater club, of course. So we all sat there and did voices and characters and had a great time. Nobody ever thought about, gosh, if my character dies, I'm going to be so upset, I'm going to kill myself. Which apparently happened a few times, or supposedly happened.
Yeah.
Or let's make a death pact. If our characters die, let's all kill ourselves, okay? Yeah, yeah, yay! Let's do that, you know?
Yeah, well,
that's ridiculous.
The average game that I go to, and these are with completely different GMs, but every game is pretty much, maybe you're there for 8 hours and maybe 2 hours of gameplay and 6 hours of shooting the crap, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, every time I would hear about these games where people would strip naked and cover themselves in goat blood and engage in these orgies, I was like, where are these games?
How come I don't get invited?
I want to go to these games. No, instead we're all sitting around and eating pizza, you know, trying to talk about, does that hit an armor class 7? Does that?
Let's not forget the unicorn, the female D&D player who would sit with us at our, and everyone at that table, regardless if they had any interest in her whatsoever, was on their best behavior because there was a female sitting there playing Dungeons & Dragons with you, and it was awesome!
Yeah, and I love how that has opened up. Women now play role-playing games probably in the same percentage as men.
I saw that the percentage was something like 42% of the gaming market is female now, and I don't know if that's right, or I'm sure someone's
going to... And some of the best designers I know are women, too.
But
I know. It's amazing.
But yeah, I think it's awesome.
Yeah, when we started playing, no such thing. By the time I was getting ready to leave Brownsville to come to Austin to go to school, to go to college, I had a group of six women. I ran a group for six female players. And let me tell you, it was a very different experience. It was very educational for me at the time. They were not really interested in a dungeon crawl. They were interested in interacting with every goddamn NPC that was in that town. They wanted names. They wanted history. They wanted what's going on. And I'm just like, wow, I wasn't prepared for this. I mean, this was just the barmaid. Well, no, they wanted the barmaids. Yeah. What's your name, honey? Where are you from?
And,
what are you doing? I threw in as a throwaway. I said, oh, the barmaid walks up. She's really quiet. And one of you noticed that she has a black eye. And I just threw it out there. I just threw it out there to see, let's see what happens. That became the adventure for the next four sessions.
I love it.
Them rescuing her from her abusive boyfriend and teaching him a lesson, and then having her become the squire to the female paladin character. And I'm like, my God.
I want to see a Conan story like that.
Yeah, before Conan goes to
Conan would just decapitate the abusive husband.
Well, or decapitate.
Decapitate.
You know, I never really clocked it over much, but I actually had a number of females in my games throughout the years, and not maybe not always with Dungeons and Dragons, but when I was playing Call of Cthulhu, there was almost always a woman in the group. Whenever I was playing, I had a long running Danger Incorporated campaign, which is pulp role playing. It was never, you know, I guess I never really thought about it too much, but I also never really ran a group that was hostile or unfriendly either. So that was always sort of you know, part of the deal. My role playing experiences have all been, you know, with only a couple of minor exceptions, have been uniformly positive. It was very fascinating to me, and I have attracted for years watching the various versions of Dungeons and Dragons roll out and regenerate the fantasy book market and turn the video games into the number one entertainment export in the country, you know? Mm-hmm. And then when it happened, it really felt like we stuck the dismount when Peter Jackson announced that he was going to do the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Right. And as soon as we started watching those, and as soon as we saw this visual language made real, this that we have we've had it in our heads for years. You know, we knew that they were going to look a certain way. We had these certain concepts in our minds, and you know, everything from the simplicity of the height difference between the dwarves and the elves to the speed of the giant spiders to the later on the terror of Smaug, you know, all of that stuff got rendered in such a way that it really felt like we had made a significant contribution to the world, especially when when Return of the King won all those Oscars. There was a certain an immense sense of satisfaction in knowing that for a brief moment we could all look at each other and go, elf? No, dwarf? Dwarf. Oh, yeah, dwarf. Yeah, you know, and we just kind of knew what we were talking about. It was really nice.
And I think that part of the change in role-playing culture to include more women came with, and I'm not quite sure, a lot of people credit Vampire with this, and I don't want to take the credit away if that's where it belongs.
Vampire the Masquerade.
Yes. Yeah. I started noticing that when games started becoming more storytelling, shared storytelling experiences rather than wargaming, I move my my miniature this many hexes and face him this way and he does this much damage. That's when I really started noticing many, many more women become involved in the hobby. And again, not to say that there's not women that are not interested in the wargaming aspect. There are.
Right.
But in general, when stories, when role-playing games became more storytelling-driven, shared storytelling, that's when I really started to see it open up in its appeal.
Vampire was probably the explosion, but I was noticing it in Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
Yes, actually, Mark mentioned that, and then you know what? That's true, because Call of Cthulhu is structured in such a way that it really is, it encourages you more to be involved in the story rather than any specific stat or number or level or anything like that.
Right.
It really is about the experience.
And ironically,
I'm gonna go to this haunted house.
Ironically, given the author it's based on, actually has a lot of good, strong female character concepts in it.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I hate to interrupt, but I'm just dying to know. And actually, more to the point, Kavrick is dying to know what the hell is down the hallway.
All right. So Farnash has led you down the hallway. He has seen nothing with his infravision, and they come to a large open door that's closed in front of you.
Oh. So it's an open door that's closed.
An open door that's closed.
Oaken.
It's a large oaken.
Oaken.
Oaken. Oh, oaken door.
It's flammable.
That's right. So, Farnash turns to the thief. Master Thief, will you do your skills upon this door?
Do you want,
check it for traps.
Okay, you want it checked for traps. You don't want it set on fire.
No.
That's my other skill.
No.
Okay.
No.
Just traps.
Control your pyromania, for God's sake.
Why?
And I mean, everything else
is rock. It's not like it's going to burn the place down.
Go open the door. Oh.
All right, so.
Did you do it?
Well, what did you roll?
In this game, can I re-roll sixes?
No.
Okay.
All right. Unfortunately, the door was trapped.
Oh!
A bout of poison gas gushes out from the keyhole right into your face. Please roll save against poison.
Oh.
We want a high number this time.
50.
That's
I don't think there's a 50-sided die.
No, I rolled a percentile die.
It just says 50.
On the D20, you chucklehead.
I think on principle he should be dead.
19.
Okay. He gasps and chokes and vomits up last night's dinner, but he survived.
Yeah, but that's just normal behavior.
That's true.
All right.
The door can be opened.
Enough of this perfidy. I lay my shoulder into the oaken door and see if I can't knock it down.
Nice.
All right, let's roll do a strength check on that.
More traps and nonsense.
Hold on. As he's doing that, I will stretch forth my rune-covered ebony staff and give him the strength of the demon.
All right.
Farnash notches a bow and stands in the back of the party.
All right. If you're going to... All right.
So his strength has been boosted. You get a +5.
I get a +5. I rolled a 16.
There you go. The door crumbles under his mighty strength and explodes and splinters into the room.
I like that.
The barbarian stumbles headfirst into the room
and
looks up to a terrifying sight.
Oh, my.
There, standing at the far end of the 50-foot-wide chamber, next to a big black altar, is the Lich Lord that you have been searching for. Kallik turns his skeletal face toward you and laughs like Skeletor.
Oh my god.
And there, also in the corner, tied and bound, is Deldar. Deldar, what was his name? The dwarven prince you were there to rescue. Oh.
Dodonicus.
Dodonicus. Okay. You have discovered the inner chamber.
Aha! All right.
So, you adventurers, you dare to come before me in attempt to fight me? My power is unstoppable. Bow before your new masters!
You craven dog, I bow before no man or sorcerer. You'll bend to my steel if I have anything to say about it. And I charge into the room with my sword out.
Let's roll for initiative, folks. Let's roll for initiative for that.
Roll high, Mark. Roll high.
I rolled a 9.
Alec has rolled a 12, so he fires first. Kallik raises his hands in supplication and brings apart the darkness of the air around him and fires an amazing lightning bolt from his skeletal fingers. The lightning bolt spreads to the entire party, and everyone must make a save versus spells.
Oh,
the save
God.
Versus spells will only do make the damage half, right, by the way. You'll all get damage.
All right.
Okay, so save versus spells.
Oh, gosh. Mm. Man, my sorcerer sucks. I rolled a 3.
I rolled a 1. I can't believe it. Oh, magic.
I think we're looking at a total party kill.
20 for me.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Yes. The jangling fool will survive. Yes,
all the bells conduct the electricity away from me.
So, well, the damage is pretty severe, and the majority of the party is down. If not dead, then severely mortally wounded. I'm afraid Morgos... you're Morgos.
I'm Morgos.
Who was the thief of
Marcus?
Marcus. Marcus. You are the only one standing at this point.
Yeah. Good
can
luck.
Can I pray to Crom?
Yes.
Hello, Crom. Are you there? It's me, Marcus.
He will not hear you. And in fact,
Kallik descends slowly the steps. Descends the steps slowly, very casually, dripping menace as he approaches you.
It is over for you.
You are all alone, adventurer. Do you wish to bow your knee and dedicate your life to serve me?
Think you've
Do you
got
have one, medical benefits?
You've got one answer here. Make it a good one.
See, Marcus is exactly Thiefy McBaxter.
Yes, he is. He totally is.
Who we all love playing with, Thiefy McBackstab.
Folks, we're going to keep playing this game until we figure out what's going to happen to poor Marcus. Thank you for joining us on the Gentleman Nerds. Go ahead and see yourself out. We're going to order another round, and the floor is ours. Yeah. So until next time we meet, this is Mickey Finn.
Hello, goodbye.
Mark Finn.
Next time, bring Cheetos.
Aaron D'Arrive.
If you have not played a role-playing game, folks, get your friends together. Go out. There's some excellent ones on the market right now, and indulge your creativity. Nothing beats the experience of a tabletop role-playing game with good friends all around a table having a great time like we are.
Amen to that. I'm Joseph Fotinos. Thank you so much for joining us. See you next time on the Gentleman Nerds. Okay.
Now you must bow before me, thief.
You're so screwed.
I'm already so close to the ground.
Do you want to? Were you an elf or a halfling? I didn't even hear that.
No, he's just jangly.
He's just jangly.
Oh, he's jangly. Okay.
I'm Mr. Bojangles.
Normally his little ass is just so close to the floor.
You can attack him if you wish. I mean, he's standing right in front of you, and he seems fairly, you know, relaxed, as relaxed as a lich can be.
I'm not sure how much a pistol crossbow will do against him.
I think your best bet is to say yes, and then wait until his back is turned.
Turn yes.
Oh, for the love of God.
My only problem, of course, is that I have this fear that if I say yes, I get something stuck around my neck that blows my head off if I disobey.
Well, no, I mean, he doesn't want to kill you. He wants to make you his slave for all eternity.
I just had this vision of Kavrick on the ground, face down in the stone, going, stab him in the back.
he's smoldering.
Whereas I have this vision of me, you know, collapsed on the floor in a very pretty position, saying, I love my alabaster skin.
I'm still the prettiest.
Right. I'm still the prettiest.
And I think what we can do here is...
Gentleman Nerds is a production of Cloak & Dagger Studios, LLC. Music by Ben Gibbs. The sound editor is Michael Ashley Finn. Web design and cloakanddaggerstudios.com by Rustix Interactive.
Promotional consideration by Grimtooth's Engineering Supply.
I'm attacking the darkness.
I'm attacking the darkness.